Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to the latest episode of Close Readings. This series we've called The Long and Short, because in it we're looking at a selection of modern long poems and short stories, modern meaning in this case from about the middle part of the 19th century onwards. And as always, our conversation will be informed by the great archive of essays and reviews and other pieces that make up the back catalogue of the London Review of Books. My name is Seamus Perry, and I teach English at Balliol College in Oxford, and I'm talking to Mark Ford, poet, critic, and professor of English at University College London. And today we are going to be talking about an extraordinary long poem, some couple of hundred pages long, though they are generously spaced pages, called Gud de Te, or pronounced in some other ways, by Ted Hughes. So, Mark, this is, I suppose, not the most well-known of Hughes's works, but should it be better known?
I think so. I think it is the weirdest poem by a very, very weird poet. Hughes was the poet laureate, and in some ways he came to sort of incarnate notions of what poetry should be about, very different from his sort of antagonist, Philip Larkin, say, who covers a different sort of sphere of post-war British poetry. But Hughes had an enormous following and became the poet laureate. So there's a sense in which one can forget how utterly bizarre much of his poetry is. And Gaudete is one of the strangest of all his poems. And it has a very sort of interesting genesis in his own life. In some ways, it can be seen as the poem that sort of makes possible what was his best-selling volume, Birthday Letters, which came out just before he died in 1998. But the poems with which Gaudete concludes were his first explorations of writing a kind of elegiac poetry, commemorating the series of deaths in the wake of which Gaudete was kind of conceived and then composed. So it was started in the wake of Sylvia Plath's death in 1963, initially as a film script, which he hoped to interest Ingmar Bergman in. I mean, I think it might have appealed to Bergman, in which you get a similar balance between, or tension between, erotic exuberance and kind of repression, which you get in Gaudete. But then Bergman never saw it. It didn't happen. He forgot about it. Then he picked it up in 1969 after Assia Wevel, who was the person with whom he had an affair, which triggered his split with Plath, after she committed suicide. And shortly after that, his mother died. And Susan Alliston, who was another girlfriend of his from the early 60s, died. And it is a poem which is about kind of priapism, you could say, erotic excess, in a kind of melodramatic way, and also in a very mythical way, though. It's a kind of mixture. We've both written about Hughes for the LRB, and I was struck by your phrase, exuberant recklessness, which seemed to me to capture a lot of what's one way of characterising this poem.
Yes, and as you say, its origins most implausibly in a film scenario, and that has quite important consequences for its style, doesn't it? Because it's all written in this very striking present tense narrative, as if it's describing a series of camera shots, and it has no dialogue, for example, so it's as if he's describing scenes for which someone has yet to supply the dialogue that the actors might use. And the whole thing has this rather kind of nerve-wracking present tense kind of quality. It's very striking as a piece of writing, isn't it? Just stylistically as a piece of writing.
Yes, I mean, it is an experiment for Hughes. He wrote a lot of radio plays, and you can see the ways in which it's the kind of antithesis of his radio plays, in that it's, as you say, it's very visual. And Seamus Heaney actually compared it to Whitman.
Is that right?
Yeah. Hughes sent it to Heaney, and he said, you know, there's Whitmanish long lines. And it is astonishingly uninhibited. In terms of readers or listeners who are new to this, they will be struck by how in some ways it reads like what a 15-year-old might write, that Hughes has found a way of writing in this extremely visceral way, which describes action and men looking at people through the scopes of rifles and things like that. And when you explain the plot, you say, well, it's about the Women's Institute, but it's not like the Women's Institute as you know it. It involves human sacrifice and dressing up in stags costumes and antlers and kind of group sex. And they sort of think this is either kind of completely crazy or completely brilliant. I think it's both. I think in an odd sort of way, the genre, if it can be that Hughes invents for this, allowed him free access to his id, which he is never that kind of restrained. But he's moving on from Crow, which came out in 1970, a kind of long poem, which again is exploring in some ways the dreadfulness of modern civilization, which is again a point that you make in your piece on Hughes in the LRB, the extent to which his whole poetic oeuvre was a kind of attempt to dismantle the Enlightenment. That's a big project.
Yeah.
But the extent to which salvation, and in this he's following D.H. Lawrence, salvation requires somehow connecting with these primitive pagan energies and releasing them and somehow uniting the body and the soul, however that can be done. So to that extent, it does belong to that line of English writing that goes back through Lawrence to Blake and to medieval writing as well, which celebrates a kind of paganism and sees Christianity, though the priapic vicar, Lum, he's not the vicar as the Church of England would approve. I mean, to give our readers a sense of the actual basic...
Yes, we should say something about the plot, shouldn't we?
The basic Don A, in terms of the main body of it, it's this vicar who convinces all the women in this small Yorkshire village...
It's more peculiar than that, isn't it? It's the changeling of the vicar.
It is. I mean, there's this prologue, which is incredibly peculiar.
Which is very hard to construe. But you do a very good job in your piece, I mean, not to mutually flatter each other for the entire hour, but you do a very good job of explaining what's happening in that prologue. And the demonic forces, as I think is what Hughes calls them, construct, as it were, a new Reverend Nicholas Lumb, an odd name, which we might come back to, a new Reverend Nicholas Lum out of an oak or some other similarly sacred tree. And it's the replacement, it's the changeling vicar who comes back and then starts screwing everything in sight in this village, this rather well-to-do village by the sound of it.
That's a really important point, that there are two Lums, you know, there are two of them. And this goes back to Hughes's own sense of doubleness, that he had a kind of doubled consciousness after the death of Plath, that somehow... Right. That he was divided or had become completely alienated from himself in some way. So the Lum who has sex with all the women in the village is actually the changeling who is created by this oak log being whipped.
Yeah.
So violence is the portal. I mean, the violence actually also includes him standing under a bull who has its belly ripped and all the innards plunge upon him, and he fights in the kind of roping mess of blood. So the kind of initiation to reach the main body of the story is extremely violent and confusing and perplexing. And it's an apocalyptic scenario, lots of dead bodies everywhere.
Yes, the dead lying in the street, and for some unexplained historical reason. And then, as you say, we get into the main plot, which is, as you say, about this changeling Church of England vicar who seduces everything female that's moving around in the village. I mean, and there also, we should say, interspersed with this, there are weird phantasmagoric episodes, aren't there, where in one of them, for example, Lum thinks that he meets all of the women of the village buried up to their neck in mud around a crater into which he descends and fights a strange, horrific, bestial, furry creature before coming back to what you might think of as the real world again. And there are other similarly kind of fantastic and mad kind of subjective episodes. But then the climax of the whole thing is that the blokes of the village, the chaps, all finally get together because they've been shown photographs by this resourceful and crafty a bloke called Garton, who's a poacher, really, who's taken some candid snaps of what's been going on, both in people's bedrooms, but also in the Women's Institute, where the women all meet. And the men storm the basement of the church where the ceremony is happening and kill him off.
Well, he's actually picked off by a rifle shot, isn't he?
Yes, he does a brilliant, there's a brilliant run scene, isn't it, at the end, where he's running away as fast as he possibly can.
I mean, it is this, I mean, the Donnay is this weird fusion of the archers with, you know, the Euripides Bacchae.
It is, exactly.
And they're right. Maenads, the women are kind of Maenads in some ways. They are kind of terrifying.
It is the scene of an Agatha Christie novel, isn't it? Or Midsummer Murders, as I was saying to you earlier on.
Fused with these pagan rituals. And like The Wicker Man, which plugs into a similar kind of sense of the pagan that's underlying the veneers of civilization of kind of 60s and 70s England. So they all think that one of them is going to give birth to the Messiah. They don't know which one it is going to be. And Lum is indefatigable. I mean, he's getting a bit tired by the end of it. And this does, of course, match on to Hughes's own, how to put it, priapic aspects of his life, that he would be juggling different women, such as in the late 60s, Assia, Brenda and Carol. And he calls them ABC in his diary. And there's a sense in which the polygamous, which is what is released when the pagan is released, is here somehow allowed full reign, but also chastised by the narrative that he does die or suffer extreme amounts of violence. So I wouldn't call it a morality tale exactly, but on one level, it does show the dangers of erotic excess, which were dangers which Hughes experienced himself. And some of the late lyrics with which it ends seem to meditate upon some of the consequences of his behaviour.
Just taking up the idea that it might in some sense be a morality tale, even if that's not all it is, and perhaps taking it in a rather solemn way just for a second, which isn't our fullest impression of the poem, it's obviously saying something about Christianity, isn't it? And something that Hughes says elsewhere about the limits of Christianity as a way of explaining human experience or human history. Mrs. Evans, who's one of the many women whom the Reverend Nicholas Lum seduces, after her husband has discovered this, thanks to Garton's crafty photography, and then a very brutal scene where he hits her repeatedly. Yes. I mean, it's a really horrible scene of Mrs. Evans being beaten up by her brutal blacksmith husband. Mrs. Evans then, one imagines, with her lips swollen and blood on her forehead, she explains what Mr. Lum has come to say. She says, "Mr. Lum has a new religion. He is starting Christianity all over again, right from the start. He has persuaded all the women in the parish. Only women can belong to it. They are all in it. And he makes love to them all the time, because a saviour is to be born in the village, and Mr. Lum is to be the earthly father." And this drives Mr. Evans into a fit of, you know, renewed violence and anger, this time against poor old Garton, who just provided the photograph. And obviously, at some level, I suppose I'm thinking about the tone of the poem in a way. This is sort of funny and odd, isn't it? But at the same time, there's something about it that Hughes absolutely subscribes to. He thinks that Christianity is just the wrong metaphysic for human life.
Thanks for listening to this extract from The Long and Short, a close reading series from the London Review of Books. To listen to the full episodes and all our other close reading series, sign up to our close reading subscription. Go to lrb.me/closereadings or click on the link in the description.